Yo, 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 Thought Warriors. What is up? Higher Learning is on. It is I, Van Lathan Jr.
And it's me, Rachel Lynn Lindsay.
Rachel, how are you?
I'm tired.
There you are.
I'm you.
You're me. I'm
just tired.
What's got you so tired, Rachel?
Work, life. I just haven't been sleeping well, you know. The usual. Nothing specific or that I specifically want to speak to.
We got
how are you?
We got Bakari Sellers on the show today. The book is called The Moment.
Mm-hmm.
And it's thoughts on the race reckoning that wasn't and how we can all move forward now. It's a brisk read. Bakari gave you 180 pages of heat. It's brisk, okay? Look at Bakari on the cover of this book. Look at him. Look at Bakari. Is Bakari a Kappa?
I see it. I don't know if he is, but I see it.
We got to ask him if he a Kappa when he come on.
Is that giving Kappa to you?
That's Kappa energy right here. This is Ted James energy. Shout out Ted James. This right here is Ted James, Geno McLaughlin, Kappa energy. Okay? You know Geno, right? You know Geno Kappa, right? You know that. You knew that, didn't you?
Uh-huh. Is he a Kappa? I don't know why I thought he was an Alpha.
No, Geno. What did you say?
Thought he was an Alpha.
You're saying Geno gives off Alpha energy.
No, actually, he does give off Kappa energy, but for some reason, I swear I thought I saw him in black and gold. I think Bakari's a Kappa.
Look at this. This is Bakari talking on the cover of his book. Oh, it's me, Bakari. Look at this. It's the moment. I'm also talking about the moment you dropped them panties, girl.
Stop. Oh, okay, I don't know if he's a Kappa. I take it back. I don't like where we're going with this.
It's me, Bakari. I got some moments for you all, right? What about the moment you wrapped him? He's married. Bakari's happily married, guys. My homeboy Bakari Sellers. So yeah, he's on the podcast today. I gotta tell you something real quick.
What?
I'm back.
You're back? You got your energy, you feel good. You feel well rested.
I'm back.
Is that what you're talking
about? I'm back in terms of basketball.
Oh, Van. What does that even mean?
It means that.
What does that mean? Back from what?
So I've been taking a lot of time just in the gym, just working on my shit, getting my shit back, putting up jumpers, left hand, right hand, doing my thing, right? But I haven't been playing. I haven't been playing because, you know, to play now at the big Kratto 44 takes a lot out of your body, you know, But I realized something. It only takes a lot out of my body because I'm not playing enough. You play, you wait, you come back, you play. I'm playing 2-3 times a week. My body's getting used to it again.
Sure.
I'm out here torturing people like I used to. I'm out here with the I'm out here giving. I was yesterday.
I'm coming.
Okay.
I'm going to report on it. I'm going to come back to Higher Learning. I want to see it.
You have to come
don't
out there and
injured,
see it.
Don't be injured. Don't be sick. Don't be tired.
I won't play one game and then quit because I didn't play like I was supposed to. I won't.
How did that game go?
I was out there getting busy yesterday. I heard people was like it's so
wait,
great.
You heard people what?
I heard people like it's the best when people go, yo, guard up. Like look, switch. I got him. When you put people in the switch, I'm moving around. I'm getting to my spots. I'm getting my jumper off. They're closing out on the jumper. I got to L basket. Who thought the big fella could get to L basket?
Question. We had a whole conversation about the Wilson. Have you broken in the ball?
Look, I'll show you right now.
Or Spalding. Which one is it? Spalding Wilson? Which one?
This is Spalding. Hold on. This is the difference between a slightly broken in NBA ball and a non-NBA ball.
What are we playing with?
this is the difference. So this
so
is
the one
NBA.
On the left is the main is the NBA.
They're both
Sorry,
NBA.
You're
balls.
Right. Okay.
So these are both authentic NBA basketballs, right? From Spalding, mm-hmm. the old one. The new one is a Wilson. Okay.
Okay.
But these are both authentic NBA basketballs. These are authentic NBA basketballs. This one is how it looks when it's new and it hasn't been broken in. This one on the right, I hope you guys are watching the podcast. And this one on the right is how it looks when it's been broken in a little bit. It, see how the leather's changing color? You see it?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, this is how. And so I need to break this ball in a little bit more. Only problem is only the real hoopers play with this joint, right? The real hoopers play with this joint. It's hard to get people to play with this ball. I play with the balls. It's hard to get people to play with it, right? But I just go out there and the quest to break the ball in has brought mm-hmm. my game back because I'm just in there, dribble, shoot for hours and hours and hours and hours. It's like some Miyagi wax on, wax off bullshit. I wasn't even trying to get my game back. I was trying to break the ball in, and in the process, my game came back. Chuch.
Well, I'm happy for you, Van. You're obviously very excited about it. Are you going to have a new date that you... plan on being able to dunk again?
I hurt myself.
You know, with all this momentum, I wouldn't want this to stop.
Okay. So when people say stuff like that, just remember that I injured myself and compassion
I
is a real
I didn't know
thing.
You injured. Wait. Time out. I did not know this. So quit and with the compassion is a real
compassion,
thing.
Compassion is an actual thing that people should have. I'm older. I hurt my foot and I'm still out here. What I've decided, because me and Ryan went to play basketball and, you know, we had to, at the end, take over. And what we decided was that I'm 44, I'm going to keep playing till 50, and then I'm going to put it up.
Okay.
6 years. But I'm getting back in shape, back to the, man, you know how much, this is the other thing about the hoop life. That's why I forgot about the hoop life. When I looked down at the Apple Watch yesterday,
mm-hmm.
I had burned 3,100 calories. 3,100 calories in the hoop life. Hoop life warfare, nigga. The fuck? Coming back, boy.
Good for you. I'm really happy for you, Van. I'm really happy.
Thank you. Thank you, Rachel. That's very positive of you.
You're welcome. Compassion.
Compassion. We have Bakari Sales on the show today. We also have lots of different topics that are on. I'm thinking about, I want the audience to stew on this. Rachel, I was thinking about this, and what you think about it as you wear your Black Women Are Superheroes Actively Black shirt that's been outlawed. Shout out to Lainey. The shirt's been outlawed. You wore it anyway.
Not here. Not in this household.
I'm thinking about ideas for the Thursday version of the show. Should we do an all interview Thursday?
No.
Done. We're not doing it. Jesus Christ.
You know why I said like that? Because
do an hour interview with like a big star or something. Like somebody we can get on there. Just do an hour interview on Thursday.
Okay.
Like we should get an hour interview.
We're workshopping this on the podcast. Only reason I say that is because I don't think that episode will do well because feedback from our thought warriors is they like to hear us more than they like to hear a guest. Now, that shouldn't stop us from doing interviews because we like to think that we bring really interesting perspectives from the people that we have on the show, or they promote things that we discuss here on Higher Learning. So a whole episode dedicated to that, I don't know how down people will be with that. That's just my thought.
I think it depends on the guest.
But how will we know? You won't.
You know what? You know what? Look, let's just think about it. Because
we could just break it off and just have it as something separate in addition to what we already do. We used to do that.
We did that during
Black History Month a couple of years ago.
Also, I'm going to take it upon myself to come up with a new theme song.
You don't like it. The people don't like it.
It's not. We should just I'm gonna do a new theme song. I want to
on the spot. Go. Wrong. On the spot. No, I don't. On the spot. No, this is what you do, Van. This is what you do. This is what I do.
This is what
I said. You do. I said this is what you do.
For me, not for you. Okay. This ain't no free show. When I feel that, I'm gonna get with Corey from The Ringer, with Devin from The Ringer. Ashley makes music, and we're gonna cook up our own joint. You know what I mean?
I can't wait to hear it.
We're gonna cook up our own joint. Our own joint. You know what I'm saying? We're gonna something, some crazy shit. Some crazy. I might rap.
Are you gonna be offended if it's not well received?
No. Like, nothing I do is well received by them.
False. Once you do it, are we gonna put it up for a vote? Or is it just like a unilateral decision that this will become the theme song?
It'll vote, right? And then if I don't like the song, I'll play the song for myself. Rachel, everything that I do is criticized. Everything that you do is like, my God, she's so great.
That's such everything an that, old narrative. You got to let that go. Facts. That's not true.
That's facts.
Let me tell you what's going to happen on the podcast today.
What?
One of the topics we're going to discuss, Reggie Bush. Watch this critique that's going to come down on me. Okay? I get critiqued all the time.
You about to go crazy and say something crazy about Reggie? Well, let's just get into the podcast.
Please, no, I'm not going to say anything crazy.
All right. Odd news to start the podcast. Meg Thee Stallion accused of harassment by her cameraman.
Mm-hmm. What the fuck?
Other side of this break.
This episode is brought to you by Vuori. I love sports. I know you do too. I also know that lots of you exercise, but if you're like me and my wife, the beloved sports gal, you're sick and tired of ugly, uncomfortable workout gear. Especially, you know, I do a lot of walking. I walk around LA. I make calls. I listen to podcasts. Here are two words that will change everything. Vuori clothing, a line of activewear that is unbelievable. The best thing about Vuori is you can lounge around in it. You can work out in it. You can go outside. You can go shopping down in your local wherever. And you never feel like you're either underdressed or overdressed. You're just comfortable. You can wear it when you're training, traveling, lounging around the house. Go get yourself some of the most comfortable and versatile clothing on the planet. Here's the deal. Our listeners get 20% off their first purchase at Vuori.com/Simmons. Once again, Vuori.com/Simmons. This episode is brought to you by Anytime Fitness. We're not all professional athletes, but we all have health goals. That's why Anytime Fitness gives you access to personalized plans and support from a coach. Plus, you can track your training, nutrition, and recovery progress with the Anytime Fitness app, just like the pros. With 24/7 access to more than 5,000 gyms worldwide, get more from your gym membership. Visit anytimefitness.com to try it for free today. Terms, conditions, restrictions, all apply. See website for details.
So, Meg Thee Stallion accused of harassment by her cameraman. A former cameraman for Meg Thee Stallion says he was trapped inside a moving vehicle while they were in a foreign country, and she had sex with a woman in front of him. He couldn't do anything. Emilio Garcia filed this suit in Tuesday in Los Angeles Superior Court. He was warned, according to him, this is all alleged in the lawsuit, that he was forbidden to ever discuss what he saw, and berated and then fat-shamed by Meg Thee Stallion. He said that he was harassed and it was severe and pervasive, created a hostile, abusive work environment. Meg's people have responded. This is an employment claim for money with no sexual harassment claim and with salacious accusations to attempt to embarrass her. We will deal with this in court. He started working for her in 2018. He quit his job in 2019 to work with her full time and then worked with her until June of 2023. So this is like kind of recent that they've stopped working together. Hasn't been even a whole year. He says that they were in Spain and she was with three other women. And then after one of the nights with those women, Meg was in the car with one of the women and they began to have sex. He said he felt uncomfortable, kind of frozen, shocked at the overall audacity to do this in front of me. He told that to NBC News. Then she said, she told him, don't even discuss what you saw. Rachel, what do you think?
I mean, listen, we've talked about this before on the podcast. I'm not going to make too many. I don't really have a lot of opinions on it because he's filed this lawsuit. Meg's team, Meg's people, because he's not just filing her, he's filing against Roc Nation and other people as well. They've said that the accusations are untrue. So I'm not going to really opine on what I think about it because I can't really say anything to it, but I will keep the same energy in regards to there is somebody who's claiming that they are a victim to certain behaviors in the work environment. So on this podcast, we say that we believe the victim. That's what we did. We did that same situation when it was Meg and Tory. So I'm going to keep that same energy and believe in the things that he's accusing. I will say this. You know, Meg's team said that he didn't make a sexual harassment claim, which he does, but under a hostile work environment, and says that they're in, like, adds it to it if you read the lawsuit. I do have an issue when people make a loss, have file a lawsuit or make some type of claim, and that's accompanied with an interview. I do feel like there was intention behind the filing of this lawsuit to publicize the claim of her having sex with another woman. That has received a lot of attention when the bulk of this lawsuit is about unpaid wages. The fact that is he an employee or an independent contractor? That's really what he's making. He's saying that he went from getting paid monthly to getting paid per gig, and he was working more hours or just the same amount of hours, but the pay was different. And so this is really also a wage claim. They're disputing that. But the headline is that she was having sex with another woman. And I do believe that that was intentional on behalf of the cameraman filing the lawsuit. So I'm not really filing the lawsuit. So I'm not really down with that. But something you said at the top of this, when you were introing this topic, made me think of, you said it was an odd claim. And a lot of back and forth on social media was saying, was kind of not believing him because he's a man making this claim. Is that why you felt it was odd?
No, the claim is odd because of the nature of it. So this is what we have to be real with when we talk about this. And this is part to me of litigating these things in the context of the society that we live in and the society that we want when we discuss them. We have to be honest about the fact that there is a set of gender dynamics that's different here. It just is.
Sure.
Right?
Sure.
There's a perniciousness in which women have that in which men have treated women, and a specific preying on women that men have done for a long time throughout history that heightens the senses and the reaction to any of this when it comes from a man. When it comes from a man, we think, okay, this is lurking in the back of most men. Whether that's fair or not, how people look at it, men have to be sort of, I don't know, controlled, and you need guardrails because there's this thing inside of them that they're natural female hunters and they're looking for ways to have sex with women. And in situations where they can't have sex with women, they'll pursue and pressure women in ways that are unhealthy. And so because of that, hey, we need to make sure we're on the lookout for these predatory guys. And that same framework just doesn't exist for women. Now, we could have a conversation about whether or not it should. You know, we can have a conversation about whether or not there's something that's lacking there. When I talk about on the podcast, young boys that have been preyed upon by older women, I just saw a story where a woman was preying upon a 10-year-old boy, calling him son, and he was calling her mommy, and he was working at the daycare and all of that stuff. We can talk about whether or not the prevalence of that has been underplayed because we have to look at men in a specific way and whether or not we should talk about that a little bit more. But typically, I mean, women aren't cast in this role. And typically, even if this did happen, typically, even if this did happen, it's not something that would be so scarring to men. Now, that doesn't mean that it shouldn't
be.
That doesn't mean that it shouldn't be. But, like, even somebody like Meg, right? Like Meg's reputation. She's in there. She's messing around. She's kissing girls. Would this guy have been so offended if Meg would have started twerking out the window? Would this guy have been so offended if Meg would have been walking around naked? I mean, I'm not saying he shouldn't be, and that's not something that would be that's too far. I'm just saying it seems as if, to me, and this is not me trying to be PC about it, it's just thinking, it's like, if I was working for Prince, mm-hmm. and then I walked into a room and like 5 or 10 people were having sex, I'd be like, oh, I work for Prince. And so the claim itself isn't odd because it's right. It's an odd claim because you would think that the sexual congress that exists around Meg, knowing how her reputation, that's something that would be kind of understood and
that's
maybe
not, true.
Not as.
That is not okay? true. That is not true. And I think that, and I saw a lot of reaction to this. It was like, well, if Meg was doing that right next to me, I would be doing, I would be looking.
That.
But you're saying that there's a, because she talks about the, and let me know if I'm not understanding you correctly. Are you saying because some of her lyrics are sexually explicit, because she is known for twerking and whether it's on stage, whether it's on social media, whether it's with her friends, that one who works in a close capacity with her should expect to be subjected to that?
No, not expect to be subjected to it. You shouldn't expect to be subjected to it. I'm just being honest. By the way, I'm not excusing it. I'm not saying that you would expect to be subjected to it, but I don't think that it should shock you.
Oh, that's
what I'm saying.
Twerking, having sex, sitting next to me in the car, because that's allegedly. That is a reach.
But once again, like, all I'm saying is, and I'm just being for real about this.
I think you're saying what a sentiment that a lot of people think.
No. I'm not saying this as a man, because the reality is this is what I'm saying. The reality is this. That's not something you can do in front of somebody that works for you or works with you. What I would think, though, is that the people around Meg, I would think that the people around Meg would be used to a certain amount of things. And look, I'm just being for real.
Just because she talks about something, right? It reminds me of the Sookie conversation when Sookie was judging that show or whatever it was, and or awards thing, and that guy came up to her and kissed her and assumed that this is giving me the same energy. I'm just telling you, this is how I'm perceiving it. Please tell me, because I want to be wrong about this. She talks about these kind of things. This is who she is. I felt like with her flirting with me, I could cross that line.
These are two different things, right? First of all, I'm wrong in the way that I'm looking. I'm admitting that I'm wrong. But I'm just being a regular person. I'm wrong. There's two differences right there. Assuming that someone would consent to something, right? Assuming that somebody would consent to something, assuming that you can go and you can have sex with Meg is one thing. If I was at a party somewhere, or if I was working with Sookie somewhere and I walked into Sookie's dressing room and she was sucking somebody's dick, I would not be surprised. This is what happened. If I was working for, hey man, you're Sookie Hanna's body person, mm-hmm. right? You're Sookie Hanna's body person. You're working for her right there. I'm not saying that it would be right? But knowing her, if I was working for her and I walked into someone and she was having some kind of, I wouldn't be surprised by it. I'm not saying that
would
it wouldn't
you be surprised if you were right if you were her subordinate and she starts sucking him down right next to you in the backseat of a car?
No.
With
and,
that?
But it okay. wouldn't. At the same time, that doesn't mean that it's right. What no, I was surprised right. that, well, like what I was surprised at was how, was how much it affected the person. I would think that if you worked for Meg or if you worked like the Sukihana thing, I was affected. If you worked for Sukihana, there would be a certain amount of like sexual congress and sexual stuff. I mean, Sukihana's on tape sucking dick. So I would assume that there would be certain things that you would be that wouldn't bother you that much.
No, that's, and see, this is where and you're already admitting you're wrong. Great, that's fine. But I think this is where the problem is. Just because you see somebody doing something, you might think you can't say what that person feels personally. They might see this person do this on stage or do this on social media, but don't think as an employee that I'm going to have to witness these acts right next to me. We're supposed to have an employee-employer relationship or, you know, employer-independent contractor, whatever it is, relationship. That I don't think that you can say because of this, you should expect this. I don't think that's fair. And I should also say that in addition to that, he's saying he was sexually, he was in a hostile work environment that included sexual harassment. He talks about that, but then he talks about other harassment issues of, and this is all alleged, allegedly. When she did, after she did this, she confronted him about it, asked him if he was in the car, told him not to say anything, allegedly. And
yeah,
then
well, she said, don't say nothing. Essentially what she said was, essentially she said, like, don't tell anybody.
Right.
Like, it, you know what I mean? Like, don't tell no one. Like, I'm just being a realist about this. This is wrong. But to be honest with you, these are the conversations that we have to have. I'm not saying that this is right, but I'm actually just being a realist about it. Everybody's drunk. Everybody's doing their thing. It's free love, free sex. They're in Spain together. She starts having, I wonder, and this is, I'm being for real about this. And I wonder if she thought she was doing something wrong. And the difference is, and I do think that there is a gender component there. I think as a man, you understand, right? As a man, you understand. Hey, if anybody sees my dick who's not supposed to see my dick, the way we socialize this, I wonder if there's a different perspective on it. I wonder if she thought that what she did was harassment or if she thought what she did was debasing to him. As a guy, you would know. Like, as a guy, you would know that would be a power play if you do something like that to a young woman, or you would be trying to rope her into something, or to a young man rope. As a woman, I sometimes wonder if we've had enough of these conversations to know. And maybe I'm looking at this with like a,
I think you're looking at it through. Yeah. I think there's probably majority of men probably think it that way, but to generalize and say all men would feel that way, I think is wrong, clearly, because of how he felt. But I also want to make a distinction with this.
Well, I didn't say all men. I never said all men would feel that way. That's right. Yeah.
I want to make a distinction that this allegedly happened in the summer of 2022. He continued to work for her for another year. So, and I'm saying this to say the basis of the suit is that after this happened, a month later, 2 months later, then his role changed. She then had him work per gig instead of giving him a monthly fee. Then he says he was subjective to this offensive touching and jokes and gestures and all of that. Then he says she brought on another cameraman. So the basis of the claim is a wage, is an employment issue more than it is for this specific act. Even if he was bothered by it, he didn't quit immediately on this act alone. It's all these things coupled together that he says created this hostile work environment, which is the basis of his claim. This is one of many. So he could have felt what you're saying to be, we don't know. He could have felt that way. But then with everything else on top of it, it's like, oh, by the way, this happened too.
So the overall point is this. I think we need to have conversations that deepen our understanding of all of these things and how gender and gender roles factor into them. Because I do think that my line of thinking in this is probably more in lockstep with some of the guys that are probably saying, hey, I wasn't molested, or hey, or I'm looking at my, I'm looking at my situation. This is like, because of my relationship to women and how I've been taught with women, because of part of this is because of patriarchy, it's sometimes it's harder for me to see women as predators. It's sometimes more, it's trickier for me to see women as predators. And not necessarily even saying that Meg is a predator, but it's trickier for me to see how something like that would like affect someone, because I'm like, oh, well, but what, two things. That, and if you're working for somebody that's like that, male or female, right? I don't know. Sometimes I think there's an expectation that shit could go down. Like, I just, like, because I'm telling you, there's a fine line between that situation right there and that she took off her clothes and started twerking in the car, which no one would be shocked right now to find out that they were on a boat somewhere, or that they were in a car somewhere, or that they were in a hotel balcony somewhere, and that Meg would have taken off all her clothes and started shaking her ass. It's like, if you can't handle that, then you probably shouldn't be working for her. You know what I mean? But you're right. This is different. This is sex. I wonder what happened.
Yeah. We're going to agree on that one. But you are right. There's certain roles that have been placed on genders in our society. And I can totally see how that's a deeper conversation that we need to have for men to recognize, hey, you might you might have been assaulted. Hey, you might have been harassed, because we don't talk about that enough. Or you're shamed if you do. And there was a lot of shaming going on with this cameraman by other men and women.
Yeah. And then, you know, after that happens, she probably doesn't want people to know this. You know, if all of that was true, want people to know, and then you start treating them like shit, blah, 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 blah. I get it. But I definitely need to evolve on that a little bit when it comes to, I mean, we need to have a deeper conversation about male victimhood. We do.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We do. But everybody's going to have to come to the table with it. All right.
This episode is brought to you by Vuori. I love sports. I know you do too. I also know that lots of you exercise. But if you're like me and my wife, the beloved sports gal, you're sick and tired of ugly, uncomfortable workout gear. Especially, you know, I do a lot of walking. I walk around LA. I make calls. I listen to podcasts. Here are two words that will change everything. Vuori clothing. A line of activewear that is unbelievable. The best thing about Vuori is you can lounge around in it. You can work out in it. You can go outside. You can go shopping down in your local, wherever. And you never feel like you're either underdressed or overdressed. You're just comfortable. You can wear it when you're training, traveling, lounging around the house. Go get yourself some of the most comfortable and versatile clothing on the planet. Here's the deal. Our listeners get 20% off their first purchase at Vuori.com/Simmons. Once again, Vuori.com/Simmons.
This episode is brought to you by Hyundai. You could be doing anything this week, right? You've got work, errands, friends, and a whole lot of fun in between. That's why the 2024 Hyundai Santa Fe is the capable SUV that's built for your life. With premium interiors, available wireless charging, and room for your whole cargo and crew. Okay, Hyundai. Visit HyundaiUSA.com to learn more about the all-new 2024 Hyundai Santa Fe.
All right, guys, it's time to catch up with a friend here. We got Bakari Sellers, author of the New York Times bestselling book, My Vanishing Country. He has a new book out called The Moment. And I showed you guys this, the cover of this book at the top of the podcast, because this is Bakari doing his sexy face to the camera. He's very Kappa coded right there. There you go, Bakari, do it. Bakari, are you a Kappa?
No.
Did you pledge anything?
I did not.
Why, bro? Why didn't you pledge?
Big, you didn't pledge.
I know, but Bakari seems like the type of nigga to do it, though.
We did have you down as a Kappa.
Yeah, no. We had you as a Kappa. You and I told them that you're very Ted James coded on the cover of this book.
First of all, Ted don't look this good. First, second, discretion is key, my brother. Discretion is key.
I feel you. Of course, you guys know Bakari, CNN political analyst, former a representative from South Carolina, history maker, youngest ever member of the South Carolina State Legislature at age 22, named one of the nation's most influential African Americans. I love that. The moment, thoughts on the race reckoning that wasn't and how we can all move forward now. Bakari, the book is talking about the reaction to 2020, the opportunities that were had and the opportunities that were not taken advantage of. Bakari, thank you for joining us. Why did you write this book? Why now?
Well, now I thought was the appropriate time because I had something to say. I steal that from Cicely Tyson, who I had an opportunity to interview on Monday before she passed on a Wednesday, I believe. And I asked Cicely Tyson, why was she writing her autobiography, you know, over 90 years old at that particular time? And she said, because I was waiting on me to have something to say. And so, you know, I had something to say at this particular time, and it was bothering me kind of in my spirit as a new father. I had a bonus daughter, Kai, who was 13, 14, 15, as I was writing the book. She's 18 today. And I had my twins. And, you know, maybe it was my youthful naivete, but I would dare say that all three of us, and you can disabuse me of that notion if I'm wrong, but probably thought that things were going to change. Maybe not, you know, enormously, but we felt like things around us were at least moving in the right direction after COVID, after we saw this kind of worldwide outpouring of support.
Felt like they had to.
I felt like it had to because I felt like the world was watching. And to my not surprise, because I understand history, but to my disappointment, we ended up in a position where we've actually regressed. And I think that there are some very tangible metrics that we can look at to show that regression.
In your intro, I thought this moment was really sad. You're talking about a conversation that you had with your dad, and you're talking about how you asked him how he feels about our present times. And he says, we are back to the starting point. We are at about 1954, which is really like, I just sat in that moment for a second, and he goes on to say more, but it's so sad and frustrating. And I'm not sure what the other words are, but there are other words that is someone who was so influential in the movement sees that we're right back where we started. Can you speak to that moment, hearing your father say that, and maybe how that brought about this book as well?
So, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of tug and pull because I don't necessarily see the same as my father does. But for somebody's point who says that we're back in 1954, if you think about that throughout, you know, history, you realize that, you know, to be back before, you know, 14 years later, my dad was shot in the Orangeburg Massacre. And he's saying we're before that time, even, you know, he went to prison, not once, but twice, once for Vietnam, once for the Orangeburg Massacre, before the assassination of King. And it's hard to objectively say that he's not telling the truth. I mean, home ownership for Black folk right now is at the same levels it was in 1960s, right? That's terrible. What is home ownership? Why do I use that? Because home ownership is the metric by which you determine wealth. That is the underlying metric by which you determine wealth. And for Black folk, we are at the same rate of home ownership as we were in the 1960s. So he is not necessarily wrong. The reason I refuse to give him credit for that sentiment, though, is that I think about Henry Smith and Samuel Hammond and Delano Middleton. I think about Jimmie Lee Jackson and Medgar Evers and Emmett Till. I think about all those people who paid what Abraham Lincoln called the last full measure of devotion, who paid that ultimate sacrifice. I think about the people who went to jail, who stayed in jail many, many nights, who know what gun smoke and cell floors feel like. And I cannot say that we have not made progress, because then the next legitimate point that you make from that is that their lives and their sacrifices were in vain. And so my retort to my dad and anyone else who may think that is that we've made a great deal of progress. We just have yet a ways to go.
What do you feel like we've made the most progress?
The fact that me, you, and Rachel up here having this conversation. I mean, there is an audience. There is a platform. We stand on the shoulders of great heroes and heroines who fought for things like the Voting Rights Act and Civil Rights Act. And then, you know, has the Voting Rights Act been gutted? Yes. Have accommodations been limited? Yes. But where they were and where they are today is not the same. I think, you know, the Fair Housing Act. I think that you can look at very tangible policy points. We have Ketanji Brown Jackson, who was just doing her thing, showing her ass today. She did a great job today on the Supreme Court. We got a Black vice president, my good friend, Madam Vice President Kamala Harris. So we've had very tangible successes. Now, I do believe that our job, the three of us who are on this show at this moment, you know, who have an ability to change the world fundamentally, our job is to drive down the cost for change in this country for Black folk. And what do I mean by that? I just think the cost for Black folk, every ounce of change we've ever had in this country has been because of Black blood that's flowed through the streets. You don't get those policy changes, 64, 65 Voting Rights Act, Civil Rights Act, without the Edmund Pettus Bridge. You don't get the Fair Housing Act without the assassination of King. My great state of South Carolina doesn't take down a Confederate flag without 9 people dying in a church. We don't have a conversation about criminal justice reform without George Floyd. Why do Black people have to give so much for this country to change? That price is too high. And so we need to focus on driving down the cost of change.
I agree. I would want, I guess what I would say is if, so obviously there's been progress cosmetically. There's been a lot of cosmetic progress. If we start looking at drivers of the life of average Black Americans, the numbers, not just with homeownership, with wealth and a lot of things, particularly if we compare them to our white counterparts, a lot of the numbers are shocking in how static they are from the late 60s and early 70s. And especially something you just brought up, if the blood tax is still that high, if it still takes George Floyd, if it still takes the 9 dead in South Carolina to get an obvious racist symbol down, right? To actually, if it's still that high, I start to become a little cynical about how much things have actually changed. It girts me up. I'm reading right now Coleman Hughes's book, The End of Race Politics. I'm reading it right now, and it's well-articulated drivel.
I can't be on here selling a book and then ask the question why. I was about to ask why are you reading?
I just read the stuff. I
didn't know he had a book out. His father said one of the nicest things to me. We were at an event for the Black Economic Alliance in New York, and I have a great deal of respect for Coleman. I don't agree with him on anything, but I'll read the book. If you read it, I'll read it. We'll do a book report together.
I would love to do that because it's once again, I think it's really well articulated drivel. I have no doubt that Coleman Hughes is smarter than me, but I just don't buy it. I guess your father, who is like a hero of mine,
yes,
like a living American. Like a hero, like that nigga in every sense of the word. Why is it important to remind him that there's been progress? Like what, like for someone who's seen so much, I understand what you said about the lives of Megger and all of that. Like, so that he feels like his life has worth? Because my grandmother says the same thing.
Yeah. Okay, I mean, for me, it's just acknowledging the sacrifices and struggle of those people whose names we don't know. You know how many people know Jimmie Lee Jackson? Not many. I mean,
yeah.
You don't know that Harry and Eliza Briggs are the reason we have Brown v. Board of Education. They don't know Sarah Mae Fleming sat down on a bus before Rosa Parks. They don't know George Elmore is the reason Black folk can vote in primaries throughout the South. I mean, these names are people who were like us, who just dreamed that tomorrow would be better than yesterday. I mean, that's literally all I want. I just want tomorrow to be better than yesterday. And I think that if we continue to live our lives like that, maybe we'll get to a point where there's a level of success and we don't have to, as Black folk, continue to try to survive. We can thrive. But yeah, it's about showing him that his life has value and meaning, reminding him that I know that history, reminding him that I'm not going to forget about those sacrifices. Because if we say that we haven't made progress, then all those people who we named and those people who we didn't name and those boys who, you know how many Black boys are in rivers and ravines? Or ravines in Mississippi. We just don't know their name because it ain't Emmett Till. Like,
sure.
we have to, I think it's necessary, and however you couch it, you may not couch it as progress, but we have to uplift them and remind people of that blood tax that you use, which is a great term, so that we, you know, if you don't learn your history or remember your history, you're doomed to repeat it.
Certainly. Yeah.
If obviously we agree with you that the cost is high for change, and if the cost should be lowered, how is it that we do that? Right. We talk like in this book, you know, you start off the first chapter talking about your response to George Floyd and having to speak to it on television. But then we see the Justice and Policing Act come about, but then nothing done with it. So when it comes to this search for equality in the justice system and with police and all these other in other different areas, how is it, you know, to build off of what Van was saying about becoming cynical, how is it that we lower the cost when the cost has been so high and it doesn't seem like the administration is doing anything?
Yeah. And so I go through that. I mean, and one of the things about this book is at the end of every chapter, for the most part, we try to set forth some prescription, which kind of makes it different from every other book you read, which is that you may not agree, right? I think the first part of the chapter is decently rooted in fact and history, that, you know, it's hard to refute that if we're intellectually honest. But we get to a part that's meant to, it's just meant to engage folk and start some discussion about the prescriptions of how we move forward. And you may not agree with those prescriptions. I talk about some criminal justice reform issues in the first chapter, or I believe it's the first chapter. We talk about George Floyd and we talk about those criminal justice issues. I talk about in the letter to Stokely, which is my favorite, we give prescriptions on how we are able to hug and love these Black boys and make sure that they understand the love that they're feeling in their homes is real. You know, we talk about COVID, we talk about white terror. So what I try to do is lay out, we talk about the Black church, lay out these prescriptions that, to answer your question, help us move forward. For example, you know, I think that there has to be a, you know, a ban on chokeholds. I don't think you should be able to do no-knock warrants at night like the federal government. I think that you should have a database, right? And that database is important. So you're no longer just going from Baton Rouge when you get fired from the police department to Shreveport when you're getting, you know, you should have a database like you have for child abuse or anything else. And so just very tangible ideals. I think, and something I didn't put in there, but as I've been, you know, thinking about this more, I think that police officers should get paid more because you pay for what you get. I also think they should undergo psychological evaluations when you join the force. And then every 2 to 3 years or so, because it's a very stressful job. And so these are just ideas. And I think we have to be a people that dream more and have more ideas about what we should look like going forward.
Yeah, I think I agree. I think a lot of times being in a survival matrix or the emotional feeling of being in a survival matrix actually quashes a little bit of that.
Kills your dream. Trying to survive. Trying to focus on making it through a day kills your thoughts about what you can do tomorrow. I mean, it does. Mm-hmm. That's the problem.
Yeah, it's difficult to imagine policing in a way that affirms your citizenship. It's hard, right? But you have to try to do it. I was talking to DeRay about this one time, and DeRay was talking about the stuff that he was doing with Campaign Zero. And he was like, you know, people can say whatever they want. Getting the chokeholds banned is a win. And like, it's a win. Like when he was working to do that, it's a win. That is a win. And it's difficult sometimes for me to take wins even. Like even in this conversation, when you say we made progress, I go, we ain't made no fucking progress, because I don't want, like, it's difficult to take wins because I just want the whole thing burnt down, but yet you have to think incrementally.
You not only want the whole thing burned down, which is a necessary feeling. One of the things is that, you know, my dad was one of those people who was a burn it down type of guy.
Absolutely.
Oakley and Mary and Barry and Julian, they were a burn it down type guy. It's funny that I'm the child of him, but I decided to go through the legislature. So I was more Julian Bond than I was. Or and, you know, you have John Lewis and you have SEL, so you have CORE, you have these individuals who are like, we're going to be within, but all of it is necessary. Part of your feeling, though, is because we live in such a McDonaldized society. Like you can literally put whatever you want out in the interwebs right now. And you can talk to a million people right now about how you feel. And if you're lucky enough or unfortunate enough, depending on what you put out there, you'll go viral. right? Mm-hmm. And then your words get out there even that much more. We want change and we want it right now. And there is a certain feeling in our community, which I don't think is wrong, is that we deserve change right now. The problem is, as I was messing with some troll on Twitter today, and as I defined in my book, I don't think you truly take in understanding what white supremacy is. White supremacy is when equality feels like oppression. And so there are a large swath of people out there who feel like now all of a sudden our fight for equal rights is oppressing them. Tucker just did an entire segment on his show on X on how there is racism right now against white Christian men and they need to fight back. And so this change that we want right now ain't going to come easy because we have people fighting against what's just.
Mm. Yeah, it's a lot. Just real quick to that, there's a fundamental belief that it's their country.
Yeah.
So I mean, there's a fundamental belief that it's their country.
But let's walk through this conversation, which is what I talk about in the book. So if we understand that they feel as if they're being oppressed, and we believe that they think and operate that it's their country, you have to understand what they're going through right now, and the reason that you have this behavior and the white lash that we're going through. It was that white lash was coined by the other van. And that reason is fear. Fear is what we're fighting against right now. They are afraid of the crowning of America. They're afraid of being replaced. They're afraid of what the statistics hold true, that they will all of a sudden be a minority. White evangelical men cannot put themselves in the shoes of somebody that is a minority. They simply cannot.
Yeah, and there's a fear of them becoming a minority, but there's also a superiority complex that is at cross purposes with the entrenched belief of inferiority. So not only do they believe that it's their country, they believe they're the best stewards of the country, and they believe that they're actually fighting to save the country by resisting ceding the country to the mongrels that will run America into the ground. The fight to stem that is as much an emotional, cultural, and intellectual one as it is a political one. But I don't want to step on Rachel real quick because this is the kind of shit that I like to talk about. Rachel, go ahead.
No, I was going to go back to the feeling that you talked about, because we've talked about that a bit on this podcast before, of that voters, Black voters in particular, don't feel like anything is being done, which, you know, you've pointed out some things that we have been progressive and some things that have been done. So in addition to fighting white oppression, it also seems like we're fighting within our own community. The Root just did this article that said why Black men are fed up with Joe Biden. We're seeing other people with platforms kind of talk about why they're not saying they're not voting for Biden, but the rhetoric they seem to be putting out there seems to be anti the Democrats. So can you talk about, because we don't, Black community doesn't feel it, can you talk about what is it that you think they are doing well, liberals, Democrats, progressives, whatever it may be, in order to help the community feel better?
Yeah, I mean, you're talking about $69.9 billion worth of government contracting, federal government contracting that's going to disadvantage businesses, which include minority Black-owned businesses, things we haven't had. You're talking about $7 billion directed towards HBCUs. You're talking about the money that's gone to Black farmers, for example. The share of Black small business ownership has more than doubled since 2020. I mean, these are really tangible things. Now, I can't go tell, you know, my dad is, I brought this up the other day on a Breakfast Club, but my dad is pissed about the price of whiting at Piggly Wiggly. He just don't understand it. He don't understand why whiting is, right? And, you know, there is a, Rachel, I can't say that you're wrong. In fact, you are very right, because a lot of these policies we see in Washington, D.C. that pass, things we know to be good, it may take a minute for it to saturate, and Black folks still ain't feeling that. It ties into what Van was talking about earlier, which is that we want change right now. When you pass this bill today that you say is going to benefit me, I need to see that in my next paycheck. That means you got 2 weeks, right? And that's just not how it works. And even worse than that, Democrats have not the last good Democratic messenger was William Jefferson Clinton. All right? We have not had a good messenger since the 42nd president of the United States of America. Even Barack Obama was a piss poor messenger along the lines of, think about the ACA or the Obamacare Act, right? Now, he was a great one. Don't get me wrong.
He was the greatest
orators of all time. But think about the Affordable Care Act. People didn't know what was in Obamacare until they tried to take it away from us. And then you're in the air and people telling you, oh my God, you know, it covers pre-existing conditions. I can stay on my insurance until I'm 26 years old. They started regurgitating to you what was in the bill that people were about to take away from it. But we literally lost elections in 2010 because people didn't know what was in the bill and nobody communicated that to us. And so it's a combination of two things. The feeling that we have, I will not try to disabuse you of that notion that the change is not real because you don't feel it. I think that we need to have that conversation, right? Mm. Also think our messaging is not on point and has not been on point for a very long period of time, decades even. But that doesn't mean that those things that I mentioned to you, just as some of the tangible changes that have been put in place, are not good policy that are directly positioned towards affecting change in the lives of Black folks.
I watched you on The Breakfast Club. It was fantastic. By the way, the book is The Moment, Thoughts on the Race Reckoning That Wasn't and How We Can Move Forward Now.
It's a lot of words. There's a lot of fucking words. I didn't necessarily call them words in the title, but that's why my hands are positioned in the sexy hands pose like that. Yeah, so they got words around it.
you were very forceful on Stephen A. Smith. I don't want to go back down that road, but you used a term that is that I think is being underused right now. Useful idiot. I think the world is full of useful idiots. And if there's one thing that I struggle, that I never want to be, should I say, it's a useful idiot. It's the time of the useful idiot right now. You were talking about specifically the things that he said on Fox. I think the question I have for you now is, are there others? Are we in a time to where there is a lack of intentionality on behalf of Black spaces, Black platforms, and Black pundits? A lack of understanding and a lack of moment meeting with a lot of these people who say things and don't really understand how their words are going to be used, misconstrued, or potentially weaponized by forces that don't mean the Black community and the American community any good. Is Stephen A. Smith the only one? Who are the other useful idiots?
No, he's not the only one. And I don't think that you can, I don't think you would, from me knowing you and the people who are around you to give you some ounce or modicum of humility, I don't think you'll fall in that category ever, which is the same reason I don't put Charlemagne in that same category, because you come from a place of inquiry. Many of the times in which you're posing or postulating ideas about policy, you're literally inquiring and on this kind of journey to have this insatiable desire to learn as much as you can. It comes from a very genuine place. The difference between someone like Van Lathan and Charlemagne or whomever and Jason Whitlock, Ice Cube, and Stephen A. Smith, as I talk about in the book, is because they have a desire to be white adjacent. They have a desire to be accepted in a community where they can give their platform to these individuals who serve us no good. I can't imagine you palling around and Tucker Carlson ever saying, let me tell you about what my good friend Van Lathan said the other day. I don't see those things as being something that would happen. I may be wrong, but that's just not the way that I see you. And I think that when you allow yourself to be that vessel, although it may be unintentional on your part, we don't have time for that to be a part of a silo, which is then used against us to reinforce narratives that erode our place in society. So right now, they just like, man, that's another nigga who think like us. Look, there he is right there. What I said about
he said it.
He believe it. And it reinforces and it it further distracts us. One, it's a distraction. It's a huge distraction. But two, and you, this isn't the first time. I mean, you know, he said crazy stuff about Michael Sam. I mean, he talked about hoodies. I mean, he's Stephen A. Smith has been long gone, right? He's hung out with Sheriff David Clark, who wore them hats like you wear. We've all been down that path, right? Mm-hmm. And with him. And so I think Ice Cube has very similar characteristics. I think Jason Whitlock has similar characteristics. I think Sage Steele is in the same category. I think Candace Owens is in the same category. And I just think they appreciate, as I said on The Breakfast Club, the white gaze, G-A-Z-E. And they appreciate it, and they bask it, and they want more of it.
What do you think about, because Van and I, Van's cracking up.
Because I got a Stella. I learned my lesson. I got a Stella for y'all.
Van and I disagree. This is piggybacking on what you just said. Van and I disagree about platforming some of those individuals that you just named on our very own platform.
Wait a minute.
Go ahead.
Wait a minute. Bakari said, y'all not want to fuck this book roll about. Y'all not want to fuck my roll.
It didn't even resonate to me until you spelled it. Because I always knew what you were talking about.
Thank you so much. I mean, I just have...
It never crossed my mind.
Because you grown, Rachel. Because you're not a... You're not a...
That's... I'm sorry. That's
in an adult body.
No. Bakari said, y'all not about to fuck up my rollout. No fucking way. See? But look. That's what I'm talking about. Intentionality. I know what I want to say, and I know I don't want it to be misconstrued.
Correct.
Isn't that sad, though? Isn't that sad that you had to do that? That's ridiculous for the people like Van. But no, do you think that we should be Van and I disagree on this. A subject that we talked about is having someone like Candace Owens on the podcast. I absolutely don't believe those people should be on our platform, giving them the opportunity to, even if we are, if we combat every single thing that they said, it still, to me, gives them the unnecessary attention when they have their own platform that they could do that on. Do you agree or disagree with that?
So for me, my agreement or disagreement is not with platforming them. My agreement or disagreement is you can platform them if you had the ability, treasure, time, and talent to hold them accountable. And the problem you have is people who don't have the time to research it, the treasure or gift to be witty enough with these individuals, right? The talent, which is the intellectual capability to go toe-to-toe with these people. Because first of all, like, Clay Travis is not an idiot. He's a white supremacist. You know, he's been mediocre his entire life. But white male mediocrity is called success in this country, right? So, but he ain't, you know, you can't just go half-ass with him. You can't just anticipate Candace Owens coming up here and you're going to be able to outmaneuver her. You have to be able to hold her accountable. And that doesn't mean say a lot of words. That doesn't mean get loud. But you really have to be in a position to do that. And if you cannot, you have to have the self-awareness to be like, aha, this ain't for me. And so that is a conversation that you and Van have to be honest about. And if there's something that is not conducive, if your point is, Rachel, we're just not in a position right now to be able to hold her fully accountable, then no, don't platform. But if we have an opportunity to push back against the lies and we are in a position and we have the time, talent, and treasure to hold her accountable properly, we may miss some things. I ain't saying be 100. But then I think that could be helpful for a larger dialogue.
Damn, yeah, you know, that means we should have her.
I mean, look, it doesn't. Who knows if someone like her would even come on the show? To be honest with you,
I mean, I think there are a lot of. She offered me 100 to debate her.
100,000?
Yeah, I said I would. I would just do it on an HBCU campus.
That's easy. That's easy fucking money for you.
I know. I mean that, but they're not real about that. They want to do something on in a little vacuum or something. I know.
Yeah. But what I'm saying is this, I'm like, and look, all of these people are smart. I've had conversations with Jason Whitlock before. I had him on a red pill. I had a lot of conservatives on the red pill. All of these people are smart. I'm not saying that they're not smart. The talking points are just wrong.
Van ain't smart, is he? I've never met him.
So when I say smart, so this is what I mean by smart. He is smart enough to do what he's doing to a high level.
And right? he can be on a show for an hour, basically, is what you're saying. Like, smart enough to navigate an hour. I got it.
Now he was just on, and everybody should go watch it. Mark is doing a lot of great stuff on his YouTube. He was just on with Mark Lamont Hill. He was just on with him. Like, him and Mark Lamont Hill did something together. And just go watch it. And just go watch the gulf between them in terms of not even in specific policy, and just the synthesizing of information as it comes into their brains,
Mark,
right?
Me and Mark disagree on a lot of things. Well, not even a lot. We disagree on some issues, but...
He's to the left of you, yeah.
But he's brilliant.
He's brilliant. Yeah, he's brilliant. He studied. I got one more thing for you. I want to hold up your... Take up your entire day. I got one more thing for you. Is Joe Biden going to win?
Yes.
Joe Biden's going to win.
You say that so in such a confident way. Why?
Well, I mean, because he asked me a yes or no question. So I was like, yeah, y'all later. Thanks for having me. No. The fundamentals are what the fundamentals are. So, I mean, let's just have a political analysis briefly. Mm-hmm. So Donald Trump has what in politics we call a very, very low ceiling and a high floor, which means that he's a 40% candidate, right? He ain't gonna knock. There's no way Donald Trump is going to somehow all of a sudden get to 52%. He's not. He has a core base. He is what he is. His negatives are baked in. What you think about him is baked in. That's first. Second thing is, this race is not a persuasion race. A lot of times when you have new people who are running for office, you have what are called persuasion races, where your monies and dollars are geared toward persuading people to vote for you because you want to drive up your likability and drive down their likability, right? This isn't that. This is a GOTV race. This is a get out the vote race. And so what we're trying to do, or what Democrats are trying to do, is get people to come out and vote for their candidate. This is where the analysis gets fucked up by simple people. They think this is a race between Donald Trump and Joe Biden. When I tell people, been telling them, Charlemagne stole it from me one time from a group chat, but this is about Joe Biden versus Donald Trump versus the couch. And the couch is a
he definitely jacked that one for you, because he took that bitch on a tour.
Man, he took that shit. I was like, why is Charlemagne going viral? And then I was like,
he took that bitch on a tour. I'm like, oh my God. I'm like, yes, that's good. Like, he took that bitch on a tour. He was everywhere with that motherfucker.
That's unacceptable. So
if you look at it's cool. Everything in group chats can be used for the greater good. So if you look at the fact that he has a low ceiling, a high floor, you look at the fact that it's not a persuasion race, it's a GOTV race, then you just narrowed it down. This race is way more simple than most people give it credit for. So now you're like, it's Georgia, it's North Carolina, right? It's Pennsylvania, it's Michigan, it's Wisconsin, it's Nevada, and it's Arizona. Joe Biden's going to do well in Arizona. Nevada's going to be close. Michigan's probably going to be the toughest, because if there's a cessation of fire between now and then in Gaza, he'll win Michigan. If it's still with what many people believe to be a disproportional response from Israel and the hostages are not released from October 7th, that's a tough sell in Michigan. Wisconsin, he's actually...
Do you believe it to be a disproportionate response by Israel?
So I think that there's a legitimate concern about the response from Israel. I also believe that October 7th, I believe Israel has a right to defend itself. And I think October 7th was one of the worst days we've had in the history of this country. I do believe, though, that Bibi Netanyahu has to realize that the number of innocent women, children, food workers, whatever it is, that number has risen beyond. And, you know, there's a legitimate saying that one is too many, but it has risen beyond numbers that are acceptable. And I think you can have this conversation is really nuanced. And I think you can have those views. I think that young people should have a right to protest. And I think they should have a right to protest on their college campuses. I also think we have to be able to acknowledge the rise of anti-Semitism in this country. I think that there are people who are standing in solidarity with the plight of Palestinians. And I also think that anti-Semitism has creeped into some of these discussions. I know people are going to be like, Bukhari, you didn't say this or you didn't say that. But I think the conversation has to be more nuanced than this or that. And I think you should be able to analyze from the perspective of all. I think that Joe Biden surprises people in North Carolina and wins North Carolina because Mark Robinson, Rachel, I want you to Google Mark Robinson, okay?
Okay.
Like, he is the wildest boy you've ever seen in your life. He's a black Republican, right? He's a black Republican.
Oh, I know this guy.
Shaped like a wet paper bag. But listen, he is a wild boy. He out there saying everything bad, right? And he is running. Mm-hmm. The dynamics are interesting, Van, because it piggybacks on what we were just talking about. You have this anti-Semite, ignorant black dude running against a Jewish attorney general from the state of North Carolina. I mean, the isms are going to play out in that race. It's going to be fascinating to see. Mm-hmm.
He is amazing. Like, he is a Boondocks character.
Oh,
he's not even a real
dude.
You're
talking about Mark? Like, yeah.
Mark is, he's something else, man.
Yeah, he's different, man. You couldn't create him in a writer room.
Yeah, like in a coon machine. Look, so I do have one more question for you. I know everybody in. I have to ask you straight up. How did you guys get it so wrong on Tim Scott? I always used to hear like what a good guy Tim Scott was. No, I'm serious.
Tim is a friend of mine. He still is a friend of mine to this day. He just like. I mean, you got family members who voted for Donald Trump. You got them crazy ass family members who voted for Donald Trump. They still your family. I love Tim. Like the way that I describe Tim is the same way I described him in the Washington Post. If Tim needed a kidney, I'd give it to him. I would never vote. Just never could vote for him.
Do you think that there's a specific grotesqueness?
Yes.
In which
I think the way he's been acting recently.
I just think
the way that he is, this Tim Scott, who's trying to position himself to be vice president of the United States of America, is a shell of the Tim Scott that when we vouch for his character, not his politics, is who we're discussing.
It would call into question his character, the way that he's been acting.
Right. And I think fair for people to, I think that level of accountability and is fair for those of you all who don't know Tim Scott and seen his behavior recently to call him out of his name and everything but a child of God. Based on the behavior that you've seen. For those of us who know him, we just got to sit back and be like, you making us look bad now, dog.
Our boy. And you know, Bakari, you know, every time I talk to you, I'm refreshed. There's something, you different now, though, bro. You naming names. Are you fed the fuck up? Like, I'm serious. Like,
No,
be honest. I've interviewed you before. We've talked. You, Bakari, you naming names. You calling out the useful idiots. The smoke is up for you. Like, what's changed? Are you sick of the bullshit, ain't you?
No, I think I'm just more comfortable in who I am and where I am in life. And I realize that my plight and position is not incumbent upon the way anybody feels about me or thinks in response. You know, as you matriculate, when you get to a point, you're worried about if someone can knock you off your trajectory based upon how they feel about you. And then all of a sudden you get to a point in life and you're just like, I'm here. I'm comfortable. I'm here now. And it allows you to be more truthful and honest.
Well, that's good for everybody who likes to read, because the book is The Moment: Thoughts on the Race Reckoning That Wasn't and How We Can All Move Forward Now. The author is Bakari Sellers. He already has one New York Times best-selling book, My Vanishing Country.
Who Are Your People? My children's book, too. That's the book I wrote for you, Van, with pictures.
There you go. I'll read that. I'll read that after I'm done reading Coleman Hughes' The End of Race Politics. I've been getting the book. I know that I'm a neo-racist, as Coleman Hughes describes it in the book. So I'm a neo-racist. So I'll figure that out. All right, Bakari, we'd love to talk to you more, bro. All the best in the world. Are you in D.C. this weekend?
No, I'm in D.C. tomorrow. Tonight I'm in Philadelphia at the Free Library on a book tour. Tomorrow night I'm in Politics and Prose.
Okay, I'll be in D.C. tomorrow. I'll catch up with you.
Sounds good.
All right, brother. Thanks for joining us on Higher Learning.
Bakari, thank you.
Thank you, Ashley. Thank you guys for the opportunity. Love y'all both.
All right.
Are you looking for a view of the world that's a bit different? Hi, I'm Jason Palmer, a host of The Weekend Intelligence, a podcast from The Economist. Join us to hear the stories that matter most to our correspondents and editors. Every Saturday, we introduce you to people and ideas that take you outside the ordinary and expand your horizons one episode at a time. Join us and see the world from a new perspective. To listen free until May 31st, search Spotify for The Weekend Intelligence.
College campuses all over the country right now are on fire. There are protests on many major college campuses, including your alma mater, Rachel. Protests over the Israel-Hamas war. And this began last week, the arrest of more than 100 demonstrators at Columbia University. And then it just continued to build momentum. But Thursday, police in Boston and Los Angeles said they had arrested protesters at schools in those cities, and at least one university closed its campus. I think Columbia has closed its campus. But right now, the colleges protesting are Columbia, the University of Texas, USC, Ohio State University, Harvard, Caltech, Emerson, NYU, Emory, the University of Michigan, the University of Minnesota, Yale, USC. And there are various demands amongst these young people that are protesting. But some of them are as follows. Stop doing business with Israel. They're calling for divestment. If you guys remember, in the 80s, there was a divestment movement amongst people. And this time the call was to divest from apartheid South Africa. That was a big, huge deal. Stop accepting research money from Israel for projects that aid in the country's military efforts. So step away from any type of military investment into Israel. Stop investing college endowments with money managers who profit from Israeli companies or contractors. Be more transparent about what money is received from Israel and what it's used for. Number five is we want to be visible, said Columbia protest leader Mahmoud Khalil, who noted that the students at the university have been pushing for divestment from Israel since 2002. The university should do something about what we're asking for, about the genocide that's happening in Gaza. They should stop investing in this genocide. Now, there are all kinds of questions that have arisen because of these protests. A lot of people are saying that these protests are making the Jewish students of these various universities feel unsafe, that they are rooted in anti-Semitism, and that there are all types of different calls and violence that are happening on these college campuses. Now, there have been numerous voices from these campuses, Jewish students, other Jewish organizations that say that the vast majority of the protesting that you see has to do with criticism of the state of Israel, what they believe to be the apartheid conditions of living in Israel, and the ongoing war in Gaza, and the just inexplicable loss of civilian life that we've seen there. Also, we've also seen just recently mass graves being uncovered in Israel in Gaza, outside of a couple of different hospitals with bodies piled up on top of them. So that's going on over there at the same time that these protests are happening. They are a hot button political issue. For the first time, a president has jumped in and condemned student protests, which you hardly ever see. Student protests has long been
on the basis of what?
What you see on the campuses. They are running with the idea that these are in some way anti-Semitic. Mm. Now, look, I am almost sure, certainly there's some anti-Semitism going on.
Of course.
Now, the question would be, because whenever there's a protest, there are going to be outside agitators that get involved to sully the protest for whatever reason. And certainly, you're dealing with college kids. They are saying things that they probably haven't thought all the way through. You know, I remember after 9/11 and we're all having conversations. I remember specifically having a conversation with someone. And we were sitting down and we were all talking about it. And they go, well, everyone who was in the towers was a participant in American capitalism. So that made them a legitimate target. I just remember going, what? Like, if we're going to have a conversation about geopolitics and about America's role in the Middle East and the world, can't we have one at the same time we understood that some lady went to work and somebody flew a plane into her? Like, you know what I mean? She didn't have anything to do with anything. It's like, whatever. So I'm sure, we're in college at the time, so I'm sure that there are things being said and things being done that wouldn't pass the smell test of what we would want to be as civilized citizens of humanity. However, the question becomes, do we as a country want to be the type of country that delegitimizes, outlaws, and suppresses student protest? Do we want Tiananmen Squares happening all over our country? Is this what we want to become? And also, is anything that the students are asking for from their universities in these demands, are any of these demands inherently anti-Semitic? And I would say no. I would say that these are students that want to be involved in their world. They want to be involved. They want to have clean hands in terms of what's going on over there. And they're demanding it. So there's another cudgel that's going to be used between people who are, talking about what's going on over there. But I think the reaction to this protest and the politicizing of the protests themselves, the reaction to it is just indicative of kind of where we are in this entire thing.
When I saw what was going on, particularly at the University of Texas, because a lot of people, classmates, were sending that to me, I couldn't help but think about the election and what the administration's response is going to be, what local politicians' response is going to be to this. And I think that it's really going to impact how that generation is going to vote in the election. And particularly with you bringing to my attention Biden's response to it, I don't agree with that response. Protesting is how we as the Black community received rights that we have. That's not the only way, but it was our right to do that, to whether it was a sit-in, whether it was, marching, it was protesting to ensure our equality or fight for rights that we deserve within this country. So the fact that these students are using that right and doing that, and now that you see the demands that are listed out, obviously we know that people come in and hijack some of these causes. You saw it with Black Lives Matter. But if the intention is to stop a genocide, if the intention is to condemn the government there in Israel and what they are doing, then I feel like they should absolutely be entitled to do that. And Biden's response should have been to speak towards any anti-Semitism that's going on rather than...
Let me be fair to him.
Okay.
And leave this in just as it is. All right. Leave this in just as it is.
Because I was going to say he should speak specifically to that rather than telling them not to protest.
Let me be fair to him. This is what Joe Biden said. All right. In recent days, we've seen harassment and calls for violence against Jews, said a statement Sunday. This blatant anti-Semitism is reprehensible and dangerous and has absolutely no place on college campuses or anywhere in our country. So he is, to your point, speaking more directly to anti-Semitism. Let me tell you it's not an issue with it. It is a simplification of what's going on on these campuses that I think is troubling. Because what this does to me, and on this podcast over and over again before this, guys, we have routinely and will always call out anti-Semitism. We'll always call out anti-Semitism. We'll always advocate and work towards, even if it means intercultural criticism, we'll always call out anything that's done to make our Jewish neighbors, brothers and sisters feel unsafe. We'll do anything that needs to be done to make sure that our Muslim and Arab brothers and sisters feel safe. Our LGBTQ brothers and sisters feel safe. Do we get it right all the time? No, we do not. But we've had the conversation about anti-Semitism on this podcast going back years. No one in the vicinity of my world is pro-anti-Semitism or pro-violence against Jews.
Sure.
Okay. I do think that this this statement from President Biden, it seems to boil the protests down to anti-Semitism in a way that's disturbing and troubling to me. Mm-hmm. Anti-Semitism has no place on any college campus. It doesn't. It absolutely doesn't. However, what's going on these college campuses is about, it's more than that. It's deeper than that. It transcends that. And to me, there is not enough here. There's not enough here about talking about what's going on protest-wise, what the protests really are asking for. I don't think the president waded into this with enough respect and reverence for what the kids are, or for what the kids are doing, for what the adults are doing. There's a boiling down of it right here to anti-Semitism. And I don't think that that's fair to what's actually happening on the campuses. That's what I would say. But to your point, I want to make sure that I give the president credit. To your point, he talked specifically about the anti-Semitism that he sees on the campuses. All right. Rachel. It's happening.
What?
I would like to, actually, I want you to play some celebratory music. Reunited. Uh-oh. Reggie. Heisman. Reggie. Cut my shit off. Tell you something right now. Three reunions that I'm happy about.
Okay.
I'm going to put them in order. The first one is Ashanti and Nelly.
Okay.
Love to see it. The second one, Reggie Bush and his Heisman. Boom. Love to see it. The third one, got to be honest with you, y'all might judge me, but I got really excited when J-Lo and Ben Affleck got back together.
They seem really happy.
They seem really happy.
It makes you believe in, like, love. It's a fairy tale story. 20 years later, what's it, 20? They come back together and they seem happier than ever. You never know what could happen. I get that. I will agree. Well, 1 and 3. Let me say this. I've really thought a lot about this because we talked about Reggie Bush and the Heisman before when we knew that he was suing and still is the NCAA, you know, for reinstatement of his stats and some other things. And, you know, we talked about whether or not we think he deserves to have the Heisman. Mm-hmm. Do I think he is deserving of the Heisman? Yes. But this is the argument that I made the last time we talked about it. And I still believe in this. All right. You said Reggie Bush was robbed. He forfeited it. He gave up before a decision was actually made by the Heisman Trophy Trust. He gave it back to them. All right. They didn't take it. They didn't make a final decision. People speculated as to what was going to be done. USC had already given back their trophy. And Reggie Bush said, you know what? He was already playing for the Saints. He gave it up and wanted to move on. And he has, right? Had a career in the NFL, an analyst on national sports networks. I can't remember which network he was on. He has been inducted into the Hall of Fame. All these things have happened. And now, NIL is out here and all these athletes are able to make money off their name, image, and likeness, which is what always should have been the case. I've never said anything different. However, the way I looked at this is like the law. In law, you don't retroactively apply a new law to the old law unless the legislature deems that okay. All right? Okay. Permits you to
the
do
legislature,
that.
The legislature deemed it.
Yes. This is where me taking things back a little bit. Okay? When I said this before, that was my argument. I said, oh, you can't retroactively apply that because I thought the NCAA is the one who took it away. They didn't. Well, actually, I'm working this out in real time. The Heisman Trophy Trophy Trust also didn't take it away. He gave it back. That means something. He gave it back. He returned it because he felt like what he was found, you know, to be a part of, what he did that violated the NCAA rules did not align with what the Heisman Trophy stands for. So he gave it back. So I also don't understand this full outreach. I take it back. I take it back. I still believe what I said before. I take it back. He gave it back.
Okay.
He didn't think that he was in line with it. And now he's demanding it back because the rules have changed. I don't understand the outrage when he voluntarily gave it up. I don't understand the outrage when that was the rule 20 years ago and he was found to have violated them in 2004 and 2005. An investigation was done. And then eventually he was stripped of his stats and then returned his trophy. He gave it up.
Can I ask you a question?
Why do they have to give it back?
Can I ask you a question? Why are you so white about this?
I'm so white about it.
This is your whitest issue. Why are you so white about this? Why can this thing happen? He ran for all the yards.
I'm so white.
Like, what? Like, why are you so, what's the deal?
I'm so white about it.
Forget about this. Because look, Reggie
got his
Heisman
back. And I thought about this, too. I thought about this. I was like, man, this
is
really a white
Heisman. Why can't Reggie have his Heisman? Like, what's the deal?
I do, obviously, listen, I could make an argument for both sides, right? Because the things that he was found to be, the things he was found to have violated had no impact on what he did on the field and his stats and his numbers, which is how he won the Heisman, right? I could say that. However, I guess I just don't understand the outrage when this is a man who didn't even wait for the system to actually do its due diligence. He voluntarily gave up his trophy and now he wants it back.
this is triggering. Okay, so he only gave it back because they were getting ready to strip it. Okay? So they were going to take it, right? And we know.
Probably.
And so he gave it back because they were going to strip it, okay? They were going to strip it, and so he gave it back. So the Heisman Trust took Reggie Bush's Heisman, okay? It took his Heisman because of all of this stuff that has to do with paying these kids so they didn't have to be, fucking slaves and generate billions and billions of dollars for universities while they don't have shit. The nigga got a charger. So what? He ran for all the yards. They gave him the ball.
Oh, he got way more than that. Oh, he got way more than
it. Don't matter. Can I tell you something right now? Whatever Reggie Bush got from outside people, how much he ever got from USC boosters, from whoever, he was underpaid. Whatever he got. He was underpaid.
But
there's no amount of money Reggie Bush could have gotten from them, unless they gave the nigga $50 million.
I agree with that.
That would have been worth what he meant to the brand of USC and to college football, period. Putting this motherfucker on video games and all kinds of shit. Give that man his...
I agree. But what if you were an athlete, who could have had those up... Who? No.
What are you talking about? What if you were what?
No. I'm saying, what if you were an athlete that followed the rules? Because these rules were in place. It's so white. I know.
What are we doing? What are we doing? Then what, by the way, what are we doing? You know what this is?
I'm just saying. And you followed the rules that were in place. And now you made me forget my thought. My point being is that I'm not saying that he is not talented. He is not deserving. He absolutely, and that's hard for me to say because everybody knows I wanted Vince Young to win the Heisman that year. that he was not deserving.
This is what the hatred is about.
No.
This is what the hatred's about.
I totally understand why he won. However, does that mean like you can just do whatever you want at the same time? He broke the rules. Those rules were in place. They were.
Okay.
They were. I'm sorry.
So Reggie Bush,
I'm sorry.
Reggie Bush gave his
they
Heisman
shouldn't have
up.
Been in place, but they are. They were.
Reggie Bush gave his Heisman up in 2012. In 2020, USC ended their disassociation with Reggie Bush. I can't wait to see Reggie in Heisman House commercials. I can't wait to see Reggie invited back into the annals. He's one of the greatest college football players ever. And to me, stripping this award from him is crazy. It was crazy.
He gave it
taking
up.
His award. Okay, I don't know what the hell. This is all Texas shit. This is all Texas shit. This is all
but
Texas.
But had they given it to Vince Young in the first place, we wouldn't even be having this argument.
Didn't Vince Young just beat the shit out of a nigga in a bar fight? Didn't he?
I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Like, first of all, shout out to Vince Young.
Allegedly, don't be out here talking about he was assaulting people in a bar. You don't know that. Allegedly.
On video.
Allegedly. He could have been defending himself. He could have been defending himself.
We're talking about athletes. Now look at me. Now you just made me white. Look, this is what I'm trying to say. This is what I'm trying to say. He earned it. The rules were unfair. And by the way, there's such a thing as restorative.
That's a personal thought.
There's such a thing as restorative justice. Like, for example, when we realize that rules were unfair, unjust, or that sentencing guidelines were draconian, or that they were being administered unfairly, yeah, we reduce sentences.
You change them.
We reduce sentences. We let people out of jail. We exonerate people.
That's a totally different situation. He went on and lived a life. This isn't somebody who had their freedom
right now,
taken away from him.
The rules
he went on and made
changed.
Millions.
The rules have changed. And this is a reflection of an understanding of how draconian and weird those rules were.
Let me just...
It wouldn't make any sense. You have the last word, but I'm happy for Reggie Bush.
Okay, do you think that he's still suing the NCAA? He's suing for defamation. But he's still suing them, and he wants to have like his stats reinstated for those years that were stripped of him. And then, you know, they lost, they had to, the title that they had won. Do you think that that should be reinstated? Because if you do, then that's where the can of worms is open in regards to, now what do we go back and do for a college program like SMU who got the death penalty? What do you go back to these other programs, coaches, athletes that, you know, tried to build off, you know, do the under table handshakes, build off their name, image, and likeness. So, you know, in order to have some type of benefit, a deserving benefit, I might add. If Reggie Bush gets that, do you think that everybody else should have their situation rectified as well? It'd only be fair.
Reinstate everybody. What do I care?
It's a lot.
Reinstate everybody. Put all the wins back. Give SC their titles back. It's not no skin off my neck whatsoever. Reinstate them all. Who fucking cares? What difference does it make in the grand scheme of things if all the wins that we know these programs earned?
Yeah.
And all the records that we know that these guys set are reinstated. They already played the games. The games have been played. They won them on the field. They lost them on the field. They did all of this stuff. I love this world of make-believe where...
Well, it's not make-believe. Like, this is something that could actually happen with his lawsuit pending, him already getting back his Heisman Trophy. If he does win and his stats are reinstated, you're going to have a floodgates of all these other people. And I don't even know how you rectify that, right? A YouTuber who created a YouTube channel. How do you reward him for what was taken from him? His scholarship was taken away. Does he go back years later and play football? How do you make a team whole that had a death penalty and for years couldn't recruit the way that they wanted to build up their program? I don't know how you do it. It's a lot.
It's fine. Whatever. Look, Reggie, I'm happy for you, bro.
I'm happy for him.
You're already living a good life. You got a good life, Reggie. All right, you got a great life. It's just things, just more abundance, just more life, Reggie. Take that. Don't even give it back to the San Diego athletic situation. Man, put that motherfucker in your crib, Reggie. Take your husband. And take your husband and put it in the foyer of your crib. Have Lilette dance around it and the kids and y'all do the whole thing. Take your husband and put your husband where these motherfuckers can see it. Put your husband on a chain, Reggie. And
don't give it up again.
Neck.
Don't
Reggie,
give it up again.
Put your Heisman on a chain and wear it around your neck and tell these motherfuckers I was the fastest nigga in the world for 3 seasons.
You done?
You, Reggie. I'm happy for you, brother. All right, we got to go. Rachel, we had some pretty bad takes on this episode. But it's fine. Picard raised the level.
He totally did. He totally did. I'm sorry. I have to go. Sometimes we have to play devil's advocate. I really don't care. I really could care less about Reggie Bush, whether he didn't have it or have it. No. I don't care.
We're back next week, you guys. Say anything caps off, but do not stop learning. I am Van Lathan Jr.
I'm Rachel Ann Lindsay. Bye, guys.